Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 17th of August, as we record. Inflation may be falling, but bond yields are still on the rise. The 10-year US Treasury yield is at its highest level since 2007, and it's a similar story for gilt yields. We are starting today, then, by looking at a sector that's typically deemed to struggle at such times, but for whom business is nonetheless booming in certain areas, and that's the insurers. After that, we are going to take a look at the companies whose weight loss drugs have had a dramatic impact on top lines and waistlines this year and ask if that momentum can continue. Finally, our cover story this week looks at survivor shares, companies that have withstood the test of time and which are still flourishing. Joining me to discuss all of this are, over the line, Julian Hoffman.
Hello, Dan. Always a pleasure.
Likewise, Julian. And in the studio, Jennifer Johnson.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan.
Insurers, then. We'll begin with them. Julian, you covered the two results that we're going to talk about in particular, Aviva and Legal in General. What did you make of them?
Yeah, it was a bit of a mixed bag, really. But a lot of the issues had been flagged up before because they're changing over their accounting to IFRS 17, which meant that Legal in General in particular saw 5 billion of shareholder equity just disappear. It didn't make for easy comparisons, but what was interesting about the results was how, in relative terms, the insurers who were more like pure insurers were doing a lot better than insurers who seem to have other business lines. So Legal in General is a gigantic fund manager, as well as a full line life insurer. And the fund management side, as you'd expect really over the last 18 months, hasn't been doing very well. And that was what dragged down the results. And their shares got marked down because the company didn't sort of compensate for that by giving back another chunk of capital. But I guess the issue really is whether, because they changed their accounting, there isn't the same level of capital to give away. So it was a little bit of a mixed bag. But Aviva seems to be doing a lot better. They've come to the end of their payout cycle, so they've paid out more or less all the money that they earned from downsizing the business in various parts of the world. But their core business is doing quite well, and it's partly, I think, because they are more focused as an insurance company, but they're also able to raise rates in a certain direction, which at the moment is only up. So if you're reinsuring your house this summer, or your car, you can expect to pay up to 20% more, depending on which brand you go for. And we could also add Admiral to that. Admiral came out on Wednesday, and they're pointing towards really quite high rates of price growth. So everyone liked the sound of that. So Admiral and even other insurers like Direct Line, which is a perennial dog share, went up quite substantially. So I think, broadly positive, but it depended very much on what you were doing as a company. That was generally the impression I got.
I'm glad you said perennial dog share there, because I was worrying for a minute what you were going to describe them as. There were lots of insurer results this week, as you've touched on, and lots of different business lines being affected in different ways. I suppose to go back to what I said at the top, you know, insurers typically in some ways are seen as, you know, very interest rate sensitive. So that probably didn't help them this week, given, you know, we saw strong wage figures and therefore bond yields marked up in the UK, which probably didn't help the insurers either. But there is one aspect of their business, certainly for L&G and Aviva as well, that is really being helped by higher interest rates. And that is, you know, the bulk annuity side, the ability to buy out pension schemes that are now fully funded thanks to those higher interest rates as well.
Yes, that's definitely an emerging... Well, actually, it's been a story for the last 6 months or so, because people have been pricing in the possibility that that would be happening. But the results actually showed that, you know, the feast has been laid for bulk insurers. Basically, what it means is that the higher interest rates have put a lot of company pension schemes into surplus, whereas the last decade or more, sort of defined benefit schemes in particular, suffered from a lack of bond yield, which has affected their liquidity. And this situation is now rapidly reversing. So anyone who goes long on long-dated gilts is getting quite good yields on those, quite good returns. So obviously a pension fund with long-dated liabilities can now match yields that will cover those liabilities. So the schemes are now in profit, and that's encouraging the trustees to consider to moving all of those liabilities over to the life insurance industry, who then essentially manage them and will do their own sort of asset matching as well to manage to pay off on those liabilities. So it is very profitable. I mean, it's something that generates a lot of fees for the likes of Legal & General and others. And we're going to see that continue as long as rates are reasonable. I mean, they don't have to be, mega high. It just has to be sort of towards the long-term average. And that helps that side of the business considerably.
Yeah, as you say, the bulk annuity side of things has been going for a little bit longer, and is, a kind of a trend which was preceded the rise in rates almost as well. But how much longer can this continue? Insurers need to hold more capital to deal with these liabilities they take on, and things have been going gangbusters for some time now, it seems. Are there limits in terms of how much business is out there for them to do, or how much they can afford to take on? Or will this just continue?
Legal & General reckons it can take on roughly £12 billion a year of liabilities like this. So they can write £12 billion of business related to bulk annuities annually. And the market is worth in total something like £52 billion. So, that gives you a runway of, maybe 5 years, 4 years, where there's a window for maturing schemes to be bought up essentially by pension funds. As you say, obviously there are capital requirements that they have to meet, but the solvency ratios, one byproduct of higher interest rates is that the insurer's solvency ratios are improving as well, because their own assets that they hold are also yielding better. And some insurers are switching over to just the long-dated gilts, as a way of hedging that, or at least a way of taking advantage of that higher rate. And they can forecast that so for quite a few years in the future. But yes, I would say you're going to see probably 4 years of growth in that area, and then they might start asking questions about whether there's enough business left after that.
Alex, I'll just bring you in here, maybe some thoughts on the insurers in general, because they have that kind of tailwind, but they have various headwinds as well, and they have been marked down a bit this year as rates have continued to rise by the market. What's your kind of take on the state of these businesses?
Yeah, just to add to that previous point as well, I was looking at one of the estimates by one of the pensions consultants this year, who think there's maybe about £1 trillion of liabilities still to be done. So five years of growth, I think, as Julian was saying, is probably quite a sensible horizon. It looks like they're kind of falling over themselves to write this new business, and there's probably capacity constraints within the market a little bit. But as you get closer to 2030, you're getting a larger proportion of the DB pension scheme universe funded, and there's probably questions about what the next big boom business is after that. The thing that stands out to me about this is, it's unusual within the financial services industry to have, this is like a genuine boom market, the pension risk transfer market. And yet the shares kind of reflect extreme nervousness and hesitancy on the part of investors. In the case of Aviva, the story, I suppose, is arguably a little more diversified, because they've got the general insurance business and sort of exposure to other lines. The asset management businesses for both Legal & General and Aviva, if we're comparing them side by side, are pretty mixed, like the rest of the UK asset management industry. So quite a fall in asset assets under management this this half, which is not a great trend. But why, you know, as to why investors appear to be discounting these businesses that where there really is a motor, you know, sort of growth engine in there. It's a little hard to say. I suppose one of the things to consider is, you know, these are enormous companies with huge hidden risks. And, you know, if you try and look through the accounts, there's quite a lot of opacity there. Understanding exactly all the moving parts is a tricky thing to do at the best of times. But when you've got such, you know, big risks coming from inflation, interest rates, and, you know, things like life expectancy, I think those maybe amount to fat tail risks. And, you know, as last year's blow up in the bond market showed, things can rear their heads in very ugly ways and very unpredictable ways. And we're still living through a difficult period for rising rates. And, you know, there could be, you know, sort of gremlins in the machine. And maybe, you know, in this boom market as well, long term, there are hidden concerns that when, you know, the industry is maybe overlooking because it's such a boom market. So that perhaps explains the hesitancy. If you're going to be a bull for the shares, you'd say that LNG is now making £1 billion in operating profit just from the pension risk transfer business. That's near enough covering the dividend, so you get a lot thrown in for free. I think it's just these hidden risks that that explains the market pessimism, which I don't know. It depends on your sort of your take. If you're an income investor, you might be happy to just sit and collect the dividend and take a long term approach to any sort of bumps in the road.
Yeah, those dividend yields are, you know, in excess of 8% now as well, aren't they? So still pretty pretty healthy, even relative to the risk-free rate. Why don't we conclude with a couple more bits on, you know, some of the general insurance, personal insurance lines, which have attracted some headlines. Aviva every quarter, every, you know, half year seems to get, you know, general newspaper interest now for talking about its private health business, which perhaps understandably is doing really well at the moment. A lot of people, you know, looking to try and insulate themselves from the risk of, you know, NHS waiting times by seemingly taking on private insurance. Nonetheless, Julian, it seems it's still a relatively small part of their business, despite growing pretty quickly, that health and protection side.
Yeah, it's not going... I mean, the interesting thing is that the general trend for health insurance in the UK has been down for quite a few years, like 20 years.
Mm.
So whatever they're doing in new business is a blip rather than a sign of a fundamental shift, I would say. I mean, partly it's because the people who can afford health insurance are unlikely to use it in a funny sort of way. You know, it's people in their 30s or 40s. If you're older than that, you already tend to be in the NHS system. And it's just fallen. If you look at it as a proportion of the total insurance business, it is pretty negligible, really. I think it's individually profitable, which is why it attracts attention. But it also attracts attention because people tend to comment on it as a sort of substitute for using the health service, because the health service in some way is useless. I mean, that's tends to be the general angle on it. But for a company like Aviva, it's not really that material in terms of the overall results. I mean, their motor and general insurance is far more important and profitable, really, on a like-for-like basis.
And on the subject of motor insurance, I mean, this is something that is certainly hitting pockets at the moment. You know, when you look at the figures from Aviva and Ameril, as you mentioned before, talking about, you know, rises of 20% plus year on year.
Ameril in particular, isn't it? Yes. And The company, obviously the biggest motor insurer in the UK, so obviously what it says is hugely material for the rest of the market, which is why Direct Line has been benefiting as well. But they're actually posting a rates increase of 23% on average for their motor policies. And I mean, you can understand why. I mean, my car service the other day cost £1,200, which was double the year before. And they've been suffering a lot from you know, claims inflation in terms of you know, buying spare parts, buying new cars, buying secondhand cars within the system for at least 18 months, and this is the net result of that. But the market liked the fact that they could they quite clearly have the pricing power to do that and absorb then the shock of inflation on the way. So that's why the shares went up quite so much, like nearly 8% on the day.
Yeah, I think they've shed some customers, but you know the ones they've kept are the ones able to pay those rates clearly, self-evidently. So you know that is helping profitability as well. We'll leave insurers for now, and we will turn to the entirely different subject of weight loss drugs, which, you know, AI has been the big market story this year, but in some ways this has been the second biggest, no pun intended, because these companies, Jen, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, have really, you know, capitalized on these new drugs, which, well, we'll get to the ins and outs in a minute, but they do seem to, you know, work pretty well, and sales are soaring as a result.
Yeah, and I guess it's particularly impressive for Eli Lilly's drug, Mounjaro. Sales hit nearly $1 billion in the second quarter. And the reason that's impressive is that it actually hasn't been approved by the FDA in obesity yet. So both these drugs, they're called GLP-1s as a class, are actually approved as type 2 diabetes drugs and have been on the market for a couple of years, are known to be very effective there. But yeah, this Eli Lilly is still waiting on an approval in this for obesity. So it's clearly these drugs are already being prescribed what's known as off-label by doctors, meaning they, you know, this is not the desired indication, but this is a real reflection of the level of demand. Eli Lilly recently raised its annual revenue guidance by $2 billion or so. Meanwhile, sales of Novo Nordisk's drug Wegovy jumped 365% in the first half. We also have to consider the fact, when we're looking at sales, current sales, that both of these companies have been dealing with supply constraints for these drugs. So these sorts of revenue figures are potentially the sort of tip of the iceberg, which is why I think investors and markets are excited about the potential.
And the most recent development, which plays to what you were just talking about varying different usages and possible uses for them, was suggestion, you know, from some data readouts suggesting that heart disease could also be, rates could be severely affected by these drugs. They could really help with that as well. That gave shares another lift the other week. Again, it's very early stage, but people are getting excited about potential applications in all kinds of areas.
Yeah, so it isn't entirely clear yet. I think this is one thing to note about this heart disease data, whether these weight loss drugs have cardiovascular benefits purely because they reduce weight, or whether there's some sort of other benefit that's not yet understood or kind of fully appreciated. If it's shown that these drugs have really defined benefits beyond weight loss, it makes it more likely that health systems will subsidize them. So the more or the wider the range of benefits that these drugs can be shown to offer patients, the better sales are going to be. So both, it was the study that we were referencing, that the data that came out last week was on Wegovy, which is Novo Nordisk's drug. But Eli Lilly's shares also saw a significant bump off of the back of that. And this is just really excitement about, insurance companies might pay for these things. Various state health systems might help to subsidize these drugs. So it just means that the potential, peak sales are even higher than we might have thought.
Yeah, these drugs are, the US is the main market, as tends to be the case with, most of these breakthrough things right now. I don't think they're... What is the state of play in the UK, other than a healthy black market in these drugs, perhaps?
Oh, I think the healthy black market surely exists. I believe that the NHS has approved these drugs for use in certain patients, but as is always the case with the NHS, it's really kind of restricted by funding, so and therefore restricted to the people who sort of need these drugs the most or could benefit from these drugs the most. So while in the US you might see people who are primarily looking for a, Wegovy prescription for aesthetic purposes, in the UK it will be kind of reserved for people who are suffering the health consequences of obesity. At the moment, I'm sure it's a very much a live issue within the NHS.
needless to say, the price tag on these drugs as well is pretty high. So it's not just a volume game. You know, just selling a few of these things could reap a lot of money for the providers.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's, you know, this is why the likes of Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk are so keen to prove that these drugs, you know, it's not just that you're going to lose weight, you're less likely to have a stroke, you're, you know, less likely to have severe heart disease. Potentially, I'd seen something even that it could have impact on chronic kidney disease. You know, the more uses for these drugs, the more likely it is that, despite the price tags, governments and insurance companies are still going to pay up, because the societal benefit and the benefit, you know, over the lifetime of a patient is potentially significant.
I suppose the bear case, if you want to describe it that way, could be broken down into three related issues, which are supply chains that you mentioned before. The fact that, you know, if you're an investor, valuations have already, you know, way up with this news, very much like the AI kind of story in some cases, but also the potential side effects of these drugs, which again, you know, it's very early stage. People aren't quite sure yet how significant they may be, but they could be significant.
Yeah. And I guess the unknown factor here is you've got people now who, you know, say that the average person who had taken one of these drugs, a GLP-1, is someone with type 2 diabetes who's likely to be, you know, middle-aged or older. We don't really have a lot of data on what happens when people in their 20s and 30s potentially take these drugs for decades. So that kind of unknown at a population level does, you know, there could potentially be side effects. It was just earlier this week, I think, that we discovered that because these drugs sort of slow down your digestive system, there's a potential complication for people taking these drugs when they go under anesthesia. You know, obviously, when you have an operation, your stomach has to be entirely empty. So there is a potential complication there. And we just, yeah, there's a lot of unknowns. This is not to suggest that these drugs are somehow unsafe. It's just that when you have this many people taking a drug, there are bound to be a handful of perhaps unexpected consequences. If we think about how markets reacted to the news of that very rare AstraZeneca COVID jab side effect, it's a kind of, in pharmaceuticals, you have to think of it as a higher they climb, the harder they fall situation. So even if a side effect is very rare, or, you know, highly unlikely to happen, or only likely to happen in a very small subset of people using these drugs, that could still have an impact on sales and on share prices. And it's because this level of hype, you know, these are really being touted as miracle drugs at the moment that are going to, you know, not just reshape the pharmaceutical industry, they could, you know, reshape whole sectors of the economy if you believe the most kind of bullish commentators on these matters. But much depends on what actually happens to people in the next couple of years on these drugs.
If things do go well, I mean, the potential consequences, the ripple effects could continue throughout a range of sectors. I'm basing this partly on one Morgan Stanley graph that I've seen, but nonetheless, it kind of shows the effect that these things have. You know, they don't just help you lose weight, they change your appetite. You know, these figures are really, you know, quite significant in terms of the decreased interest in, as you'd expect, kind of sugary baked goods, things like that, and the increased interest in eating fruit and vegetables. I don't think it's about taste, but I think it's just about, you know, impulse and things like that. So, you know, that could have effects for, you know, all kinds of food manufacturers, consumer staples, things like that too, which very hard to gauge at this stage, but could be significant across society, really.
Yeah, that's what people are saying at the moment, is that, you know, if you're a company that makes snack foods, or if you're just a food manufacturer in the US in general, if at a population level, say, you know, I think the forecast was, you know, say 7% of the population is taking these drugs in the US, that, and, you know, their appetites are reduced by up to a third, or I don't exactly know the number on the appetite reduction, but if you have a significant appetite reduction at a population level, then it is, it's foreseeable that this could impact sales of certain food products. Perhaps on the more sort of realistic side, a couple of other analysts have noted that these drugs could be bad for medtech companies that make diabetes devices or CPAP machines for sleep apnea if there are fewer overweight adults. But I would kind of urge some caution here. I think we're still going to need effective treatments for type 1 diabetes. People will still have sleep apnea. Perhaps the size of those markets will indeed be reduced by these drugs. But, you know, we're not going to see, you know, sales of you know, potato chips drop to nothing in the US, more or less overnight. And, you know, people will still have conditions that are linked to obesity. There might be, you know, people who don't want to take these drugs, especially if side effects, information about side effects emerges. So it's the potential here is clearly very exciting. And as you did mention, Dan, there's, I think, kind of a school of thought that says these drugs don't just reduce your appetite, they actually reduce your cravings, reduce impulsive behaviours. So, you know, is there a potential use in you know, treating certain addictions? We just don't fully know or have data on that yet. So from an investor's point of view, I think if you're looking at these companies at the moment, a lot of these benefits are priced in. Lilly's on 47 times forward earnings. Novo Nordisk is slightly cheaper at 31 times forward earnings. That is because, of course, Eli Lilly also potentially has one of these blockbuster drugs for Alzheimer's. Novo Nordisk really is a diabetes drug company first and foremost. So it's, you know, it's perhaps now is not the opportune moment, given that these shares have shot up as they have. But there's clearly a long-term growth story here.
Could I just add on that? I mean, I think it's really, really hard from an investor's perspective at the moment to make the, you know, back the winning horse in this, because I think Pfizer as well is also developing its own weight loss or appetite-suppressing drug. And how this all plays out is going to be very hard to... Well, it's impossible to tell right now. But what partly explains these huge multiples, I would argue, is there's two things which get investors really excited. One is the intangibles. So it's hard just to launch a new competing product overnight. You've got to go through, you know, this is just the nature of the pharma business, isn't it? You've got to put up huge capital for research and development, and then you've got a kind of moat protecting the drug itself. And then the second one, which I think is arguably more powerful, this kind of pharmaceutical than others, is the kind of network effect. So when you know your neighbour or your friend has taken Wegovy and it's worked miracles for them, then there's this kind of ripple effect that it could potentially have in encouraging prescription or consumer style interest in a drug. Which possibly explains why there's just this real fevered appetite for the, you know, for the shares, if not food going forward. And US food sales falling, Morgan Stanley says. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, there are barriers to entry here as well, but equally there is a bit of an arms race here going on too, aren't there? I think, you know, there are pills as well as injections coming to the market, and Pfizer is one of those trying to develop them too. So there could still be other winners, but it's a story that's going to play out over the weeks and months and years rather than anything in the immediate term. However, our final section is very much on the long term. It's on our cover story this week, which is on survivor shares, companies that have withstood the test of time, companies that are still doing well today, which may have been doing pretty well 100 years ago. Julian, we will bring you back in because you wrote this piece.
As someone who has withstood the test of time, I thought it was appropriate.
You were, at the coalface.
Yeah, exactly. So the piece I looked at, I kind of got interested in this really from reading bits on how family companies tend to be more profitable. And it got me thinking about how, you know, how does a company do well? How does it thrive? What makes it durable over many years? And it was quite a fascinating rabbit hole, because you tend to go, once you get into it, you actually see that there are lots of variations in how this actually works as a concept. So you tend to find companies that can endure difficult circumstances, but they fundamentally don't have a business case that supports them in the long term, or, you know, they're just sucking up capital for no reason. And then you find other examples of companies where there is a family somewhere in the background that holds a controlling share, but they barely take any interest in what they're doing, and yet the company is still successful. So it was, the piece was an attempt really to sift out what makes for a durable and interesting corporate story that translates into stock market success in the long term. Really, that was the aim of it. And I mean, he came up with some interesting stories, but it is a very difficult topic to define accurately, I think, because you end up sort of trying to find, you can't really equate longevity with quality. I think that's one trap that you can fall into as an investor. I mean, it's just because something's been around a long time doesn't mean that it's any good. You really have to align looking at how long something lasts with actually how well it's run. I mean, that tends to be a common denominator in long-term successful companies. But there's no rhyme or reason to it, other than they perhaps have a culture that breeds excellence in what they do, and that sort of self-perpetuates. Whereas another company that struggles tends to have the same problems over many decades. So it is an interesting topic, and I hope investors will find something useful in it.
Well, one of the tensions that you explore in the piece is in some ways, capitalism by its nature is about creative destruction, and it is about the new replacing the old. And the question is whether companies can do that internally in some cases, really. I mean, there are cases of companies that have existed for hundreds of years, or certainly decades, which are now entirely different to what they were 100 years ago when they first started out.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because there are some that are so good at what they do that they last literally centuries. So the oldest company in the world is a Japanese construction company that started out in the 6th century AD. And it's still a Japanese construction company that can come around and do your bathroom. But it was set up 1500 years ago.
yeah, that is the flip side. There are some which have stayed on the same track this entire time.
Exactly, but then there are the others who kind of evolve themselves to match the circumstances in which they find themselves. I mean, a classic example, and obviously it's quite a boring one in some ways, but is Berkshire Hathaway, because obviously that starts out as a clothing company with roots in the 1830s Rhode Island, and someone called Warren Buffett took it over and made it a holding company for lots of investments. So that's an example of longevity being driven by an understanding that the core offering isn't working anymore and that you have to do something completely different. There are others who build on the success of their founder's vision, as it were. So if you take a big chemical company like DuPont, for example, I mean, that was founded on an understanding that the local product wasn't particularly good. In that case, it was gunpowder. And they've just added intellectual property over many decades. And, they file something like 35,000 patents a decade. So, I mean, that's a stunning record of excellence coming through, and the constant need to innovate and bring something new to the market all the time. And that sort of helps you stay ahead of the destruction curve when you're talking about creative destruction within the mechanism of capitalism. So that was another aspect of it, which was quite interesting, change, either you that change is either forced upon you because of circumstances, or you companies take the conscious decision to change their offering and that way become more successful and thrive. And it tends to be the ones who are stuck in a particular rut that would say wouldn't survive longer than the vision of their founder. So it was quite an interesting way of looking at it, I think.
As you say, it was interesting to the way you characterize it, some companies having change thrust upon them, because there are examples of companies who, have effectively collapsed and come back. I believe, my limited knowledge of the subject, that Kongo Gumi was one of those a few years ago. But Rolls-Royce, another example, obviously famously in the 70s, it reinvented itself or was forced to reinvent itself or move away from some of its original areas, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a full service engine maker, wasn't it, at one point? And you know, they also made the cars as well as the engines for the cars. And that bust episode when they went bust in 1972 and had to be rescued then by the government was the catalyst for building a much more valuable company. So, you know, their intellectual property lead in aircraft engines is considerable. You know, Rolls-Royce engines are famously more powerful and lighter and smaller than the equivalents you get in America or in Europe, for example. And that shows the need to be innovative and concentrate on what they do well, and that's how they've succeeded, and that's probably how they've partly had the reputation to pull through the last few years. I mean, they managed to get away quite a difficult funding round in the middle of the pandemic, which guaranteed that they had the cash to survive. And you can only really do that on the back of reputation. I don't think that's an intangible. There's an intangible quality to survival in that sense. So, you know, if people trust that your core business is worth saving, then they'll put up the cash to save it.
Yeah, and we're really seeing the benefits of that. In that, well, shareholders are in the past 6 months finally with the big turnaround in the share price there. As I say, that is the cover feature this week. You know, we look at businesses like that going through thick and thin. We look at, you know, some of the survivors in a different way as well, who just keep chugging away each year. So there should be something for everyone in that feature. Unfortunately, we've run out of time today, though. So thank you to Julian. Thank you to Jen. Thank you to Alex. And thank you to you for listening. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.